Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 30th, 2025, and our friend Andrei Martyanov is back with us. Welcome, Mike Andrei.
My pleasure.
Andrei, whenever we talk about the conflicts in terms of the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine, in the Middle East, the future of China, and the situation between China and the United States, the main factor to be evaluated is the military of the United States. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump came to power. He thought that he can defeat Yemen, and he sent and he tried to fight Yemenis so far. How do you find, what is the situation, the current situation of the American army? And how did you see the way that Yemenis are fighting the United States in the Red Sea?
No. We have to understand, by not trying to denigrate United States Army, it's definitely an army with its own history. There are some own, esprit de corps. And then you have, of course, yes, when we say army, you have to understand armed forces. And there is, of course, glorious U.S. Navy, which is, made a gigantic reputation, totally deservedly, during the Pacific War. So I by no means try to, denigrate or diminish them. But truth is, for the last 30 years, well, more than that, actually, it was primarily the mythology, U.S. media, and they call it for a reason that it was military-industrial media congressional complex. So, and U.S. media and Hollywood are really good in promoting this, clean image, and but reality is, of course, it never was as powerful as it is tried to portray itself. And even by 1970s, the all fighting concepts, for example, of the U.S. Navy and its carrier-centric nature have been basically put into question by none other than at that time Chief of Naval Operations Elmer Zumwalt, Admiral Elmer Zumwalt. Because with the development of the long-range strike capabilities, and these were Russians who introduced first, real anti-shipping cruise missiles which could hit things, as Israelis learned in 1967 after Eilat was sunk by Egyptian Kamar-class missile cutters, essentially. So, then suddenly the whole idea that you can move there, this floating, rumbling, giant of the CBM, the nuclear power carrier, to some third world country, and you can start bombing it because using the obviously the deck cycle, as much you can launch all those either sustained strikes or alpha strikes or whatever what have you. It kind of feed American psychology of the war, and the really idealized idea about the air power. And as a result, you see yourself today that it's not that difficult to exhaust the stores of the missiles in what is the today the carrier battle group and its main air defense complex, if you wish, which usually a couple of the Arleigh-Burke class destroyers with 96 cells of the MK-41 VLS, which is vertical launch system. Not all of them obviously carry the anti-air defense missiles, but at least half of them does. And those are ranging from SM-3s for intercepting ballistic missiles. They think that they can't really. But, and all kinds of other missiles, they have the SM-6. So that's about it, they have their ream, those Sea Sparrows variants, which is evolution of the those missiles, and what it takes. It takes probably, 100 drones to immediately, make it expendable, essentially, the whole store of those missiles, and then suddenly what happens? You have to move your aircraft carrier, which is an extremely valuable asset. The carrier itself, the hull, without air wing, is anywhere between $10 to $13 billion. It is immensely the most expensive asset in military ever. So can you imagine the political and actually military ramifications if something hits it, let alone if something damages it, not to speak about sinking it. So what do? You have to move it away deeper into the ocean or into the sea to stay away from all those, well, long-range fires. They could be very primitive, but still they can fly hundreds of kilometers. And suddenly, everything you knew about it, yeah, you can fly your F-18s, whatever you want, and you can bomb the whatever, you know, from Yemenis, for example, that they have enough wherewithal down there to continue to launch those old subsonic anti-shipping missiles, which are shut down, obviously. But when you have enough of them, what do? You deplete the carrier battle group of its defensive weapons. Simple as that. Of course, they theoretically can go and get all those F-18s with, you know, with the shoot down, look down, shoot down capability, you know, against the clutter of this sea, and shoot down some missiles or some drones, but you will not be able to control it completely. And as a result, we saw what happened to Truman aircraft carrier a few days back, when it had to maneuver very violently to evidently avoid the whatever was flying towards it. And basically what happened, it you know, one of the F-18s and the TAG, the, you know, the thing which you know, the which moves it around the deck, they fell over the deck pretty much. That was the result. You see, that's simple. You do not have to have any more one-for-one type of the weaponry weapon system. You can do it just basic math and basic technologies.
What can they do, in your opinion, in with the case of Yemen? Is that an option to go underground to fight Yemen?
Yeah, that probably inserted some forces, you know, they're like special forces, I don't know, SEALs or what have you, but obviously they are not capable to conduct real warfare. No, United States cannot go into Yemen unless it wants to experience second Afghanistan, okay, and that will actually also mobilize other people to come to help. So it's... No, United States cannot take casualties, and so that's the result. And yes, this operation now lasts for what? It has the funniest name ever, Prosperity Guardian. You know, it's just like, what the hell is that? But yeah, it doesn't achieve any success. And the main goal, military and political goal, to unblocking the essentially Red Sea and Suez Canal, hasn't been achieved. There are marine traffic there is down 90%. Evidently, who just won? You know, if they can keep this thing, you know, closed, and they have to go around, you know, Africa, which is extremely expensive and it's much longer. So yeah, it is what it is. I mean, nothing could be changed about it. And it doesn't matter how many. Well, you theoretically can put all aircraft carriers there. They can bring definitely a serious air power, but you know, what can I say? I mean, it's what are they gonna bomb? You see, that's the other funny part. They can bomb only civilian targets primarily. That's the thing.
Yeah, they're short of targets in Yemen because yeah. They don't have that much of intelligence coming out of Yemen.
No, yeah, you can do some through the satellite and recon flights, but Yemenis shoot down those Reapers, MQ-9, whatever the name of those drones, really nicely, you know, that they know how to deal with that thing, you know. So in this case, yeah, you have the limitations in terms of the intel. You have to obviously have the targets and you have to identify them. Otherwise, it all ends up the same as in Afghanistan. You blew up their family or, you know, wedding or any kind of party of the civilians, women and children. So that's what you end up doing. But reality is, of course, yeah, you have to have a very good intelligence. You have to have a high probability of identifying targets. And But evidently, it's not the case anymore. And as I already stated also, that once you begin to move your aircraft carrier away, which is like now suddenly it's hundreds of kilometers, you cannot move it closer than, I don't know, 300, 500 kilometers. So suddenly your ranges become, well, much longer for your aviation. You know, you have to constantly have those. They have the F-18s, which serve as the refuel aircraft, or you have to have the larger aircraft, which have to fly into the area to, you know, get your fuel for your attack package, you know, F-18s, and that suddenly complicates the situation, you know. And again, you have to put your carrier back to port to replenish this constantly expanded, you know, this ammunition stocks and stores and things of this nature. So yeah, it becomes very complex. I mean, it's you can definitely kind of secure more or less your carrier on station, but this is until, and that's where it all becomes interesting. Many people ask if they have their Houthis have their Bastion and P-800 Onyx in the export version, which is Yahant. It goes onto the export as Yahant. Syrians used to have that. It's 300 kilometer range. It's limited by 300 kilometer range against the, it's standard between 800 and 1000 kilometer range. But this is a completely different game. And that's why I also think that's why they moved the carrier also back, you know, in towards the sea, because with Yahant, it's a completely different game. These are Mach 2.5, and they are violently maneuvering, and they are actually have their, well, what would we define today as artificial intelligence. So do they have that? Who knows? You know, what it takes, if you read actually the book by Douglas McGregor, which was his best book ever. After that, it wasn't as good. But that was an outstanding book, Breaking the Phalanx. And he says that what it takes to scare the carrier battle group is somebody to drop the drum of oil accidentally overboard and everybody like freaking out. Here, what it takes, somebody can simply insert the even fictitious information that, oh, yeah, they received Yahants. And guess what? That would immediately they have to go, because in this case, it's very difficult to intercept that, if possible at all, if it is a salvo, and you don't want to deal with this, because that thing, single missile, can sink the destroyer, okay? So, and that's the conundrum U.S. Navy is facing now, and yeah, that is why there's very little success. You cannot just, you know, go around there bombing something. They bomb some caves, maybe, you know, so they have the good infrared and good, you know, optronic systems too, but other than that, you have to go to Sana. What are you going to do with Sana, the capital? Do you want to bomb the whole city with the civilians? You know how it will look like. So that's what we have.
We know that the United States Navy wasn't able to, in the way that they were using the bunker buster bombs to just destroy the arsenal of Yemen. It seems that there are people talking about that Donald Trump in his first administration ordered a new sort of bomb, nuclear bomb, a new bunker buster bomb to do that. Mm-hmm. Andre, to my understanding, when you use a nuclear bomb is just on the surface, it's just spreading on the surface. It's not that much deep. But how is that possible that they have a new sort of bomb, a nuclear bomb, a bunker buster bomb, which is different from what we've seen so far from the United States, that they're preparing to, I don't know, attacking Yemen or maybe Iran to use it?
Let's put it this way. While the United States remains the nuclear superpower, there are a number of technological issues which the United States is facing now, which they do not want to admit, or as some of our common acquaintance was trying to sell as some kind of unheard of achievement, when in reality it is the actually a manifestation of the inferiority. For example, those fuses for the nuclear MIRS, from multiple reentry vehicles, for Trident II missiles, or for that matter, but especially Trident II missiles. The reason being is because in order to defeat, for example, the Silas of the modern Russian, already starting from the 70s actually, but 80s and now, is, what is the Silas of the land-based ballistic missile in Russia? It can withstand direct hit, but exploding over it, up to 150 to 200 kilotons. It will still remain operational. So what you need to do, especially when you shoot with the Tridents, you, in order for you to diminish the time, to cut the time of the flight of the those, the, you know, the bus itself, the missile and the bus when it separates and then warheads fly, you do it by the suppressed suppressed ballistic trajectory. They're not this parabola, you know, but it's much more suppressed, you know. It still flies into space, but it is much more suppressed. And what you have, you begin to lose, because it is obviously suppressed, you begin to lose accuracy. So what you need to do, you need to some kind of the fuse which have to at least explode over the silo. And that's the only thing which is essentially tells you, oh, okay, so you're suppressed, you still cannot hit it, you know. So, and this is exactly what is happening now. What would be, for example, in this case, the, you know, bunker buster nuclear device, you probably will have to have some same technology like the bunker buster, but with the nuclear warhead, which can penetrate deeper. Could it be done? Yeah, I'm pretty sure they could, but that's the issue. There is a huge issue with the nukes themselves and processing and creating new nuclear warheads for the United States. It is issue with the plutonium and all kinds of things of this nature. So, we have to understand, whenever we talk about it, is it technologically feasible? Yes. But what if they use nuclear weapons on Houthis? That is going to be the outcry all over the world, and they will humiliate themselves even more themselves, because that will tell you how impotent they are to deal with this threat. And make no mistake, I, while sympathizing with people of Gaza and all that, you know, and even with Houthis, I understand, but what they do is actually against the international law. They did indeed choke they're one of the major choke points of the shipping lanes of communications for the international trade. So it's kind of like, it's such a, how to say, blade running also, almost like. And so in this case, the political consequences will be horrendous for the United States. Horrendous. I mean, it's just, my gosh. So if they decide to do it, let alone if they try to do this to Iran, my gosh, let's not go there. It's going to be a United States will not recognize itself the next day, if God forbids it happens, you know, because of the reaction of the international community and the rest of it. So.
Yeah. Andre, we had a meeting between Donald Trump and Zelensky in Italy. And the way that Donald Trump himself is talking about the conflict, do you see any sort of consistency in his manner? Do you see that he's helping? Maybe let's assume that Witkoff is trying to do everything right and trying to make some sort of move. But how about Donald Trump himself? Is he helping Witkoff if that would be the main objective?
We don't know. Well, I will have to go with Peskov's, Mr. Peskov's statement, which is, I think, absolutely correct when he state that most of what you read in media is garbage. You know, it's a don't go and don't believe that thing. Use only primary sources. But of course, primary sources do not leave us much kinder. But we know Russian position. It's not changing. But Trump, as already have been stated many times, he wants ceasefire. He doesn't want the peace. And that's the difference. He cannot put together this, no matter how he tries. Russia is a movable object. And Mr. Lavrov in Brazil yesterday, he confirmed this. He reiterated all the same points which Russia was at since 2021, essentially. So he gave the interview to O Globo newspaper. And so what do you expect? It's up to Trump how he adjusts his behavior, but considering the fact that he's a narcissist, self-obsessed guy. He believes himself that he can do something grandiose, you know, and then suddenly he begins to face the reality when Witkoff comes to Moscow, Putin and others reiterate to him the same point, Witkoff being a good guy, he gets these messages, gets him those to Trump, and explains to him the same thing. Root causes. These are root causes. Then Lavrov comes out and he repeats it. Then Medvedev comes out and he repeats that the regime in Kyiv will be destroyed. So whatever you want. So do Russians ready to talk to Kyiv? Oh, yes, they do. Formally, they do. Absolutely. But they know that Zelensky cannot do that. Because once he does that, he tries to, first, he's illegitimate anyway. But again, Russians today stated, oh, no, we're not going to be signing anything with the United States. Let Ukraine come to us, you know. So it's a game. And Trump is not in the same league of playing this game with Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Putin, no matter how he thinks that he's such a grandiose guy. And of course, we know that he got this nincompoop, a moron, basically, Kellogg and all other type of their advisors, if you wish, who are absolutely incompetent and not qualified to advise him on anything serious relating to Russian-American relations, you know? So, and yeah, you look at this like, who knows? But, yes, if you listened to what we spoke to each other, both Garland on Monday and then yesterday with the Colonel Davis, we were discussing this issue. For Trump, he doesn't have much time left. Doug McGregor already says that it's his war. But if he doesn't do it before May 9th, and after May 9th, it's his war. I'm sorry. No matter how he tries to pretend that he tries to resolve the conflict, you know what? Even considering the fact that he has the interest groups, people who press him or influence him, but he put himself in this position that he started to make those grandiose statements about that, oh yeah, I can stop it in 24 hours, now it's 100 days, now who knows what it is. But the point is, he could have stopped it immediately. He didn't because he wanted the ceasefire. And he also, well, in terms of Europeans, we know who they are. So, and May 9th, let's wait and see what's going to happen after May 9th. And if he doesn't make any conclusions on his, and he is absolutely ambiguous in this respect, he sometimes has lucid thoughts, but most of the time it's mostly, you know, hot air, basically.
You've mentioned Peskov. He also mentioned that Kyiv doesn't have full control on its army.
Yeah.
This is important. This is a concern in terms of the security, in terms of any sort of ceasefire, whatever they have in their mind, a Ukrainian settlement. Who's behind that part of army which is not in control of Kyiv?
Well, part of it are British. Some part, maybe less smaller Americans, but mostly it's Nazis. It's a Western Ukraine Nazis, which are supported, by the way, by London and by Germany. And well, which, surprise, surprise, you know. So, yeah, that's who they control the army and the punitive organs, so to speak. And they're in full control. So, and Zelensky, no matter what he does, trying to, let's say, surrender, if you wish. Let's call it what it will be. He will be off immediately, either by British, the only thing they are good at, killing defenseless people, or by Nazis themselves, you know. So, and nothing he can do about it. I mean, those territorial defense, and also the very many, those clusters, if you wish, of the Nazi units or formations are spread all over Ukraine. They still do not want to do the full mobilization of the Western Ukrainians. They would rather see those Eastern Ukrainians die. You know, so it's genocidal in many respects. And what can I say? That this is the house of horrors there, and it's a madhouse, and it has to be treated like that. And that is why Mr. Medvedev today says, yeah, we're going to destroy Kyiv regime. After that, we'll see.
It seems the reason that Russia has changed its policy, that they're, right now, as you've mentioned, they're ready to talk with Zelensky and the administration in Ukraine, because Zelensky is so much influenced, Andre, by Europeans. Somehow Donald Trump cannot manage that. I don't understand that, why Donald Trump is not able to do that. Well, that's why maybe Putin has decided to himself.
No. It's all statements. I mean, they're obviously going to state it, but Trump got humiliated all the time. I mean, he's getting humiliated left and right. He talks to Zelensky, tells him all the time to go pound sand. Europeans tell him to go pound sand. For all intents and purposes, he screwed up in Canada because obviously he scared the hell out of them. And guess what? Canadians again, elected those liberals, which will finish off the Canada as a normal state. Not that it was normal nowadays, but still. So yeah, the guy obviously he doesn't understand what he's dealing with. Again, his only good appointments have been Kash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard. The rest of it are either neocons or, you know, morons like Kellogg. So he continues with his first term now. Grandiose statement. He does rally after the first 100 days. The economy is tanking. Everybody laughs at his tariffs. You know, it's just like, dude, I mean, what the hell? Wake up. He will not be able to do that, and that is, you know what, this is not good for United States, to put it mildly, you know, let alone for his administration. So, but we'll see. He could have done it really fast. He didn't.
And the reports coming out today show that how deeply the Trump administration 1.0 was involved and try to not let Donald Trump meet with Vladimir Putin. I would argue why they don't meet and talk directly. What is the main reason for not doing that? And who's, when you look at this administration, do you think they're getting somehow, we are getting somehow the same sort of outcome from the administration as we got from the first Trump administration? Because the way he's managing the situation is not helping his policy, and he's not doing anything to change it.
Well,
he's talking with Putin directly and meeting with him.
Oh, no. I mean, they did hold some talks over the phone. Putin correctly states, and all Russian top officials, they say correctly, what's the point of meeting in person when there's nothing to discuss? Big time leaders, they meet in person only when it's already have been decided and things have been prepared. So they come in after their expert groups, you know, did everything, and they sign or settle on whatever was decided already after the hard work by diplomats and militaries and intelligence services and things of this nature. So the only thing which he did so far good, Donald Trump, is that, yeah, he opened the channels of communications with Russia. But it is important, make no mistake, it's a good thing he did. But I mean, as Putin correctly states, and many people say, it's what's the point? To discuss what? We can discuss it over the phone. If you wish, give me a call. We'll talk. I will reiterate again the position. Apart from the fact that Larry Johnson compiled this wonderful, essentially, the series of his articles and his blog, that it's with the numbers. Trump was the guy who actually started to rearm Ukraine and prepare them for the conflict with Russia. It was his first administration. He was primarily was doing Twitter thing, you know, obviously not running the country. So we'll see how it goes now. But So far, it's difficult to even understand what he's trying to accomplish. So, but we'll see. Let's give him the benefit of a doubt for another week or so, and then we'll see where we go with it from there. So,
Andrei, Ukrainians, do you think in the victory day in Russia, do you see any sort of threat coming from Ukraine? There are some rumors that they want to attack. I don't know.
There are rumors. Zelensky absolutely stated that. No, it's a real threat. It's absolutely a real threat. And especially after which is the stupidity of the many Russian legislators who started to import Ukrainians with the start of the, starting from 2014, by the way, importing through this bunch of their, sleeper cells, which continue with the terrorist activity. London would love to kill as many Russian civilians as possible, so because they cannot kill properly military men, but they are good at, like Crocus City. It's all, absolutely real threats, terrorism, and FSB, of course, and FSO, Federal Service of the Secret Service, essentially Russian version, and they have their hands full, obviously. So, but yeah, there will be attempts, no doubt about it.
Andrei, how on the battlefield right now, it seems that Ukrainians want a 30-day ceasefire.
Yeah, of course.
Are they trying to do you have some sort of feeling that they want to provide weapons to Ukraine in this 30 days, and that's why they're asking for this?
They need to reorganize and resupply whatever is left on the... if you look attentively at the map, every day just moving west, west, west. It's already in Kharkov Oblast. It's already on the right bank of the Dnieper. So, and yeah, those neocons, especially Kellogg, and obviously this butcher, Sirsky and all that, desperate, of course. So, no. Russians give them 72 hours, especially for Russian reasons, if they will try to do something stupid, the response will be immediately very energetic. But things continue. No, they're not getting ceasefire. The 30-day ceasefire, well, it's all crap, basically.
You mentioned Sergei Lavrov. He talked with Global News here in Brazil. And he just put out whatever it's in the mind of Russians, what they want to get from a Ukrainian settlement. Do you think in that tone of Sergei Lavrov, is there anything for a permanent ceasefire the way that Donald Trump wants?
No. He already stated specifically about that. But they want 30. He said, we're ready to talk without preconditions. And here I quote him: the demand of 30-day ceasefire is a precondition. So no go. So as simple as that. So listen, Russians are extremely prudent, and in terms of this legal language. And so believe me, when you listen to this correctly, people like this. I have people who in my blog are panicking. Oh my God, what he's talking about? The Russia surrenders. Yeah, guys, read attentively, listen attentively to what he's saying, especially against the background of the root causes, which are constantly repeated. And the root causes have been defined. And demilitarization, denazification continues. And Mr. Medvedev, who is, by the way, he is above even Lavrov. People forget that Mr. Medvedev is the second man in command in Russia. He's a deputy chair of the Security Council of Russia. He is the first deputy of Mr. Putin. And sometimes people do not understand what is going on. And I understand Mr. Medvedev is a bad cop, but the problem for them, they have to pray and for Mr. Putin's health and next term, because he is the reasonable one. Mr. Medvedev is a genuine article. It's not like he's doing this because he has to. It's what he thinks. I mean, and everybody knows how he thinks.
And he called the new chancellor of Germany a Nazi.
Oh, yeah, he is. I mean, scratch any German politician, you will get the Wehrmacht or Nazi officer. So
it seems that everything's getting worse in Germany, Andre.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's going to be really bad. And everybody saw now what happened to Spain and Portugal. And the only reason they cannot come up with the proper explanation, because everybody knows, they wanted their green energy, let them enjoy it. And this is just the start. It will be much, much worse. This is how Europeans kill their own countries. And you know what? They voted for this. What can I say? Let them continue to enjoy it. Same as Canadians. Listen, I understand that, Trump was very anti-Canadian and anti-Trudeau and all that. But these morons, pardon my French, they still go in, you know what, elected the same people who will make sure that Canadians will cease to exist as people. So what can I say? You know, you guys, you bear responsibility for that, you know. No matter what anybody says, nobody forces you. Granted that a lot of elections are rigged, but you still can go and make the proper choice, but they don't. So it's like, are they dead brainwashed? Evidently, let them enjoy it. You know, what can I say?
I don't know if you saw the interview of Sergei Lavrov with CBS, Andre.
Oh, yeah, I saw the parts. I mean, I cannot tolerate any bimbo like Brennan or whatever, you know, from some establishment, Gibsonian outlet, pretending that they understand something. They don't. Most of the people who work for the establishment media in the United States and in the West are morons, okay, including their chief editors and all. They know their playbook, how they have to. So it's not worth even paying attention, because Lavrov was playing with her. I remember how Megyn Kelly once tried to show that he's smart in front of Vladimir Putin. She probably didn't even understand. She was humiliated, okay, because it was so in gentlemanly manner when he called her, you're a specialist in the electronic warfare. And so that's what it is. I mean, they're bimbos, okay? They have no integrity. They are just dressed up bimbos with degrees in journalism who know how to string several words. They have these instructions and they pretend that they know people. I mean, it's useless. Yeah, Lavrov was looking at her like a flea, okay? It's just, which he is.
And she asked Lavrov about the Arctic. And do you know what's the problem in the Arctic, that and how Donald Trump or the United States wants Russia to help them in that region?
Well, Russia doesn't want to help United States. Russia may consider some of the energy project with the United States on the basis of joint venture, which if Trump would have been smart, he would have been immediately grabbing onto it and trying to return the American companies into Russia. Which is, in many ways, it would have been extremely important for the United States in terms of landing softly, not crashing with the host of economic problems the United States has now. But Russia is not going to help the United States, and the United States lost the Arctic race because the United States cannot build even simple good icebreaker, let alone the fleet of the nuclear icebreakers, let alone what is coming with the leader class, which is going to be, it's already being built, which is a 70,000 ton monster, you know. So Russians are developing their Arctic route, and people will be coming too. They are coming already. And it's a short, reliable way. And for China, it is also extremely important, because obviously against the background of the clash, economic clash with the United States, and having its shipping lanes of communications exposed in the Indian Ocean, suddenly China, well, they love this idea of the Arctic route, which is defended by Russian Northern Fleet and, you know, is getting better and being, you know, properly prepared and equipped and all that, including their icebreaker fleet by Russia. So there you go. That's what it is.
An important, in my opinion, statement by Lavrov, and when he talked with a Brazilian newspaper, said that Russia is willing to improve its relationship with the United States, but they're not going to do this at the expense of its existing partners.
National interest, yeah. It's all, listen, what we hear for the last 100 days, these are reiterations of the same point over and over, different words, difference, but it is all, and the phrase which is there constantly, root causes. Unless they are addressed, things continue as they continue now, and Russia can do it as long as it takes.
And the decision for Donald Trump is to decide do they want to cooperate with the other part of the world, or they want to confront them?
Well, the present state, or rather lack of mind in Washington, they still think that they are such a hugely massive, powerful country as they... No, they're not. The United States is still a superpower, but it's a declining superpower, and it is obviously lost standing on so many critical positions, and especially after being humiliated militarily in Ukraine. So, yeah, I mean, they think that they can, as Houthi has shown, they're not intimidated. And these are Houthis, for crying out loud, okay? So, and now they saw what the real war looks like, you know, in Ukraine, and the United States doesn't have the stomach for that, you know. It never did, really. It's United States is extremely sensitive to its losses. So, and we saw their level of the operational planning, which is, pardon my French, is pathetic. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's you cannot take those people seriously and professionally. So.
Modi wanted to be in Moscow on the victory day. Right now, with the conflict between Pakistan and India, he has decided not to go.
Of course.
Andre, do you find what's going on in Pakistan? Is that related to BRICS? Is that related to the way that we had J.D. Vance, if you remember last week, he was talking about how they're going to be closer to India. They're going to make, I don't know, form a new sort of military cooperation. How do you see the situation between India and Pakistan, and how is that related to the situation of BRICS?
Are probably related, but I think it's it what happened, obviously it was Pakistani who did this atrocity, you know, who committed this atrocity, and it's difficult to say where it originates. Some people say it's London again, you know, so who knows, is it related to BRICS? Anything when it comes down to important BRICS members, and India is certainly a very important BRICS member, is BRICS related, you know. So, and especially when you look attentively at success of the BRICS summit in Brazil and those things happening with the US dollar. So who knows who initiated this thing? Pakistan, obviously, it's a nation in a horrendous state, economic and cultural and all other things, you know. So, and we know that this conflict is, you know, 80 years old essentially, so since British left, and so it probably will continue for observable future. I don't know what's going to happen, honestly. So, and it's understandable why Modi is not flying to Moscow.
And the Minister of Defense of Pakistan was asked on British media, and why are you supporting the terrorists? He said that for decades we are doing the dirty work for the United States and the British government for the West.
This
is the Ministry of Defense, the Minister of Defense of Pakistan talking. It's not some ordinary guy on the street talking about.
It's again, we have to understand the special military operations started there, well, actually already 2014 and Maidan in Ukraine. They started the processes which those nincompoops from London and Washington had no reference point in dealing with. They don't understand scales obviously they are not very good mathematically and engineering wise, let alone militarily. They thought that, oh yeah, it's going to be easy. There you go. So how's that looks now? And they started the processes which are tectonic in their nature, and as a result, yeah, Europe is going down. Western civilization, as known, is going down. It's actually decrepit, basically put itself into the decrepit state completely on its own. But people do not understand the real history. They don't understand that what we're observing now are the final salvos of the World War II. And because essentially what we see, the whole 20th century, Europe desperately tried to commit suicide. It committed suicide in World War II. The only saving grace for a while was that the United States, which was spared by war and which actually profited greatly, stepped in into Europe and not saved it for a while. But it already was getting rotten, you know, and going down the hill starting from that point. And as a result, we see what we have to we see today. Again, as already stated, those blackouts are coming to Europe on more frequent basis, believe me. Spain is done. I mean, they wanted the 60% of the solar. They got it, okay? And the very hot Spanish summer is coming. And let's see how they will be dealing with this. And people say, oh, you have a bout of Schadenfreude. No, I don't. But, I mean, I have Schadenfreude in regards to the political elites of the West. They are morons. They're cretins. All those billionaires, all those Bezoses and, Musks and all that. They are actually, they leave out, so to speak, and they consume the heritage which was created by the Western civilization, some of which was absolutely magnificent. I'm a Western man. I am a Western man by culture, by outlook on life in many respects. But combined West today is not West anymore. It's something else altogether. It's completely, you know. So, and you look at this, yeah, that's what is coming. Germany, you're going to be third world guys, you know. And same goes for the, especially the, you know, the south of Europe. And they don't have energy. They are being diluted demographically, and their men lost manhood. You know, their women are just... So, yeah, I mean, there are some people of common sense, obviously, in Europe, but they are not the majority, and you cannot save it, you know?
You mean the leadership?
No, I'm talking about the among population. Leadership is altogether, it's good Lord. Look at Germany or France, a bunch of cretins, basically. And let alone, United Kingdom, you don't see any normal person there. Well, look at the, all kinds of psychological and psychiatric anomalies, you know, be that Macron or Scholz or this cretin nurse who is coming in, and Medvedev calls him correctly Nazi because he is. So, and yeah, you look at this, these are not normal people. But they now want to allegedly get rid of von der Leyen because she's toxic. Hello? You were all, singing praises to her. It took only special military operation to start those motions and expose them. Well, it's the emperor's new clothes, if you wish. So,
yeah. Thank you so much, Andre, for being with
us.
Great pleasure, as always. Take care, Andre. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.